16th Fajr International Poetry Festival has wrapped up with an award ceremony in Tehran. The literary event aims to honor Persian poets from Iran and the world with the ultimate goal of elevating Persian poetry. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An endangered Mediterranean monk seal has embarked on a new solo adventure after spending months under the care of conservationists. Four-month-old Evie was released back into the wild on February 15th in northern Greece. Evie was rescued when she was only 7 days old. She had been washed ashore and separated from her nursing mother during a storm. However, conservationists found the lucky seal and started taking care of her. Even though Evie's health was poor, she recuperated quickly.
She was really dehydrated in the beginning, which is very common with pups that separate from their mothers at such an early age. And the first few weeks were critical for her health because there's basically no way to replenish, like to replace the mother's milk. So we have a certain protocol and a food regimen that we provide along with vitamins and other supplements to the seal. And thankfully, in the first few weeks, she showed signs of her health status became better.
The conservationists hope Evie will be able to join a community of her species soon. They will be tracking her movements with a chip. There are only a few hundred Mediterranean monk seals left in the wild. About half of them live in Greece. Entrapment from fishing, pollution, depletion of food resources, and climate change are some of the threats facing the species.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new Oxfam analysis finds that 99% of humanity is worse off due to COVID-19, while the world's 10 richest men have doubled their fortunes during the pandemic. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, After 2 years of COVID, report finds pandemic made for deadlier by greed. Here's the story. If a single word can encapsulate why, 2 years into the global COVID-19 pandemic, the virus continues to spread widely and kill thousands of people each day despite the availability of life-saving vaccines. The humanitarian group Oxfam International suggested that the word is greed. In a new report titled Pandemic of Greed, Oxfam offers a grave assessment of the current state of the public health emergency in an effort to bury the notion that the coronavirus is on its way out and normality is on the horizon, a rosy and potentially dangerous sentiment voiced in recent days by the leaders of rich nations and the executives of powerful pharmaceutical companies. While effective vaccines provide hope, their rollout has tipped from a natural desire to protect citizens into nationalism, greed, and self-interest, reads Oxfam's report compiled on behalf of the People's Vaccine Alliance, adding, large numbers of people in low-income countries face the virus unprotected, and millions of people would still be alive today if they had had access to a vaccine. Big pharmaceutical corporations have been given free rein to prioritize profits ahead of vaccine equality. Published almost exactly 2 years after the World Health Organization, WHO, officially declared the novel coronavirus a global pandemic, Oxfam's analysis brings together a slew of data points that, taken together, paint a picture far more dire than the one U.S. President Joe Biden presented during his closely watched State of the Union address recently. Biden said in his speech, because of the progress we've made, because of your resilience and the tools we have tonight, I can say we are moving forward safely back to more normal routines. Oxfam's report counters that. In the United States, where vaccination rates are lower than in Europe, the deaths from COVID-19 have remained high, on a par with previous waves of the pandemic. More broadly, the group notes an estimated 99% of humanity are worse off because of COVID-19, 160 million people have been pushed into poverty, and 137 million people have lost their jobs. While the pandemic has had far-reaching and destructive consequences, touching countless lives directly and indirectly across the planet, Oxfam makes clear in its new report that not everyone's livelihood has been harmed by the public health catastrophe. The report notes the richest 10 men doubled their fortunes during the pandemic, and a new billionaire is being created every 26 hours.
Of those new billionaires, 40 of them have made their billions profiting from vaccines, treatments, tests, and personal protective equipment. Oxfam emphasized that the pain inflicted by COVID-19 has been disproportionately concentrated in poor countries, which have been denied sufficient access to vaccines by rich nations and profit-seeking pharmaceutical giants that have hoarded doses and technology. Mazar Sayoum, Global South Convener for the People's Vaccine Alliance, said in a statement recently, rich countries and corporations have tied up the global response to COVID-19 for their own benefit, leaving the Global South to bear the brunt of this pandemic. As billions of people are still unable to access vaccines, some have the audacity to claim that the pandemic is over. That is an utter fallacy. Third and fourth doses in rich countries alone cannot erase the ever-rising death toll in lower-income countries. To convey the extent of the pandemic's devastating impact on low-income countries, Oxfam's report observes, for every life lost in a rich country, another four people have died in a poorer nation. 54% of all deaths caused by COVID-19 have been in low- and lower-middle-income countries, where 10.6 million people have died. 2.7 million people are estimated to have died in high-income countries, 14% of global deaths. People in poorer nations are 1.3 times more likely to die as a result of the pandemic compared to rich countries. Per capita deaths in low- and lower-middle-income countries are 31% higher than in high-income countries. Every minute, four children around the world lose a parent or caregiver as a result of the pandemic. Almost half of these children are in India, where over 2 million children have been affected by orphanhood. Worldwide, Oxfam estimates that 19.6 million people have died as a result of the pandemic. That figure, which includes deaths directly and indirectly caused by COVID-19, is far higher than the official estimate of roughly 6 million deaths from the virus alone. At least 3 million people have died since the highly contagious Omicron variant was detected by South African scientists in November. The only way to prevent the emergence of new mutations and finally end the pandemic, Oxfam argues, is an urgent change in a strategy that includes a suspension of coronavirus-related patent protections, the transfer of vaccine technology to developing countries, and a massive increase in funds for global vaccine manufacturing. According to one recent study, producing and distributing 3 coronavirus vaccine doses to every person in low- and lower-middle-income countries would prevent over 1 million deaths for the cost of $61 billion, a fraction of the $778 billion U.S. military budget. To date, just 13% of people in low-income countries have received at least one coronavirus vaccine dose. Anna Marriott, Oxfam's health policy manager, in a statement said, "After 2 years, we all want this pandemic to be over. But politicians in rich countries are exploiting that fatigue to ignore the devastating impact of COVID-19 that continues to this day." While incredibly effective vaccines provided hope, rich countries derailed the global vaccine rollout with nationalism, greed, and self-interest. Marriott added, "Suggestions that we are entering a post-COVID era ignore the continuing deaths in primarily lower-income countries that could be prevented by vaccines." Communicate.
Jean-Luc Brunel, a famous French model scout and fashion industry figure, has been found dead in his prison cell in what appears to be a suicide. Brunel was a close associate of infamous billionaire and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who is also supposed to have hung himself in his cell. We've heard about Epstein and the sex trafficking and the victims who've come forward, but why has the media said nothing about the blackmailing aspect? That Epstein and his close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, were using underage girls to gather dirt on politicians so they could blackmail them? And what about the relationship to Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad? Today, we're going to try and answer these questions and look at the saga a little more carefully. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On Saturday, February 19th, 2022, Jean-Luc Brunel, a prominent French model scout, was found dead in his cell in La Santé prison in what has been called a suicide. Now, you might be wondering, why should this be of any particular interest? Because Brunel was not just a big figure in the fashion industry, he was also a close associate of billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Brunel stands accused of sexual assault and having partaken in alleged sex trafficking ring run by Epstein. To be frank, he was providing young girls to Epstein for sex. And for lack of a better word, he was a pimp. Now, according to one of the victims, Virginia Gouffray, Epstein admitted to her that he had, quote, slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls. And it was from Virginia Gouffray's civil suit against Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, that we know of Brunel's name as well. And this is one day that we see these court documents unsealed, one day before Jeffrey Epstein's death. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was known for living a lavish life and always inviting very prominent figures like actors and high-level politicians and businessmen to fly around with him on his private jet. And so Jeffrey Epstein would go and invite these people to his private islands, right, where they would have intercourse with underage girls that he had trafficked through his associates, such as Maxwell or Brunel, who were running these fashion and model agencies where they would get these girls from. And so following the revelations of this scandal, you know, people are starting to wonder, are these prominent figures, the politicians, the actors, all of these people we see in the photographs with Epstein, did they also participate in this sex trafficking ring? Because many of their names appear on the flight logs of Jeffrey Epstein's private jets. One of those names is, of course, Jean-Luc Brunel. The flight logs list him as a passenger 25 times on Epstein's private plane. And so who exactly was Jeffrey Epstein, the real Jeffrey Epstein? And why are there so many secrets surrounding this whole case? Now, back in 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty for soliciting a minor for prostitution. He served 13 months in jail. But unlike most prisoners who have to stay in prison, Epstein was given the luxury of being able to work out of his office 6 days a week. Now, one of the women who has come forward to accuse Epstein of sexual assault is Maria Farmer. When Maria Farmer was just a young art student, Epstein bought one of her paintings. She was recruited to work as his art advisor. And Farmer claims that Epstein showed her an entire system of secret video surveillance that he had set up inside his property with cameras in the bedrooms and the toilets. Now, Farmer was the first victim to officially report Epstein's behavior and abuse to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. However, at the time, you know, the authorities just didn't seem to take her accusations seriously and there was no investigation. When Ghislaine Maxwell found out that Farmer had paid a visit to the FBI, she began threatening her with physical violence.
What sort of threats has she made against you?
Originally, it started with things like, I'm going to burn your art, and then I'm going to burn your career, and then I'm going to burn you and the house you live in. And then it was, oh, be careful crossing a street. You know, you can get shot in the back of the head. You know, they were threats against my life, and I told the FBI this.
It wasn't just Maxwell, Brunel, and Epstein doing this. The victims have also accused many high-level officials, billionaires, professors, even the British royal family, Prince Andrew, of having partaken in this sex trafficking. Epstein provided them with young girls, which they abused. Now, earlier, I talked about the flight logs and how Brunel's name appears there. But you might be more familiar with former U.S. President Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, whose names appear multiple times on Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was finally arrested on July 6, 2019, on federal charges for sex trafficking minors, and he pleaded not guilty. They then put Epstein in New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as MCC, and they put him on suicide watch because he reportedly tried to take his own life. Now, when you're put under suicide watch, that means you're under 24/7 surveillance. But after an assessment by a high-level psychologist, Epstein was taken out of suicide watch, and they put him instead in a special housing unit, or an SHU. And so barely a month after his arrest, on August 10th at 6:30 a.m., Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his cell by apparent suicide. And it turns out that the guards had fallen asleep and there's no camera footage. And with Brunel's suicide, the same thing. There's no camera footage. The cameras were not working. Now, look, there are many theories floating out there about Epstein's death, specifically because a lot of things don't add up. And even then Attorney General William Barr, he himself admitted to some, quote, serious irregularities.
I was appalled, and indeed the whole department was, and frankly, angry to learn of the MCC's failure to adequately secure this prisoner. We are now learning of serious irregularities at this facility that are deeply concerning and demand a thorough investigation.
There are also numerous suicide prevention experts who also expressed serious concern. Senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, Eric Balaban, raised questions as to why Epstein's life was risked by putting him in this restrictive special housing unit, or SHU, specifically when he had shown suicidal tendencies. According to him, an SHU is just not an appropriate thing for someone who's shown recent suicidal tendencies. Now, I can recall as I was attending the extradition hearing of Julian Assange, one of the people testifying was none other than Maureen Baird. Maureen Baird is the former warden of that very prison, MCC, where Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And she spoke about the prison conditions there, specifically about pretrial SAMs. However, she did note one thing, that Jeffrey Epstein was the first person to kill themselves at MCC since 2013. Now, to be honest, I cannot know how, you know, for sure how Jeffrey Epstein died, whether he simply decided to end his life because of all the pressure from the trial and the public exposure and the lengthy sentence awaiting him, or whether he was killed because he was too dangerous and the elites wanted to tie up some loose ends. But let me tell you something that we can verify. This wasn't the first time Jeffrey Epstein was in jail, as we were saying earlier. He was arrested in 2007. But how come he got off so easily? Well, it turns out that Alexander Acosta was the Miami Attorney General at the time. And while he was being interviewed a couple of years later for the position of Labor Secretary by Donald Trump's transition team, Acosta revealed that, quote, "I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone." And now you see why he cut Jeffrey Epstein a non-prosecution plea deal. If all of this wasn't enough, you know, all of this horrible sex trafficking, it also seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel had ties to at least Israeli intelligence, if not also American intelligence. You know, Epstein had been known to brag about working for the Mossad, and Acosta just gives him a slap on the wrist because he knows that he's working with intelligence. Now, Epstein's longtime partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, is known to have been both a KGB and Mossad agent. You see, Robert Maxwell was a very, very famous media tycoon who owned 6 national newspapers in the UK. He also famously stole around £500 million from his own workers' pension funds. Now, journalist Whitney Webb, who's done fantastic work on Epstein, she's written extensively about Robert Maxwell's exploits as a Mossad agent in great detail. At one point, for example, Robert Maxwell acquired a company called Information on Demand, which was a front. It was a cutout for the Mossad. And they sold an Israeli piece of software called Promise, right? And this software was sold to governments around the world. And it had a back door inside it, allowing the Israelis to penetrate and spy on the very clients they had sold it to. So Robert Maxwell even sold Promise, this software, to a Los Angeles-based firm called Sandia National Laboratories, which provided Israeli intelligence with direct access to the core of the U.S. nuclear weapons program and nuclear weapons technology. And speaking of nuclear technology, it's also believed that Robert Maxwell is the one who tipped off the Israeli embassy in London about the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, after Vanunu had divulged the existence of Israel's nuclear program to the press. Right, Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped in Rome. They flew him to Israel and then sentenced him to almost 2 decades in prison. And when the issue of Robert Maxwell being a Mossad spy was brought up, because you have to keep in mind, he was also a member of parliament in the UK, so this was quite the scandal. And when this was brought up, no one would print it because the press feared being hit with a libel suit, right? So instead, what happened is George Galloway and Rupert Allison, who were both MPs at the time, they went and raised this issue in the House of Commons, exposing Robert Maxwell as a Mossad spy. And by extension, this allowed the British press to start printing about it without fear of reprisal or fear of being sued by Maxwell and his lawyers. And just a few weeks later, mysteriously, Maxwell died after allegedly falling off of his yacht. He was buried with full honors at the Mount of Olives. And you know who attended his funeral? The Israeli Prime Minister and President and at least 6 former and serving heads of the Mossad. Maybe that will give you an idea about how important he was for the Israelis, that all of these figures are attending his funeral. And so that's Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? But if you thought the only connection here to the Mossad was her father, well, you'd better think again. Journalist Jeff Shalev conducted an interview in 2019 with an individual named Ari Ben Menashe. Ben Menashe was a, quote, Israeli consultant and former arms dealer who also served as a senior executive for Israel's Directorate of Military Intelligence from 1977 to 1987. So this puts Ben Menashe in a unique position to divulge about Epstein and also Maxwell, because he met them both 40 years ago when he was working for Israel alongside Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. And so in this interview, Ben Menashe is asked, quote, you spoke about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell as being part of Israeli military intelligence. Do you know specifically which unit? Ben Menashe replies that, quote, because of Robert Maxwell, they worked directly with military intelligence. I don't know who they answer to. The interviewer then continues, would you say that she was an agent as well and in military intelligence as well? Ben Menashe says yes, yes to both. And so Ben Menashe also makes another thing very clear, that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the entire point of their sex trafficking operation was to, quote, blackmail American and other political figures by specifically seeking out underage girls for their friends. And as for Jean-Luc Brunel, he used his modeling agency to traffic girls to Epstein, right? And unsurprisingly, he had an office in where? Tel Aviv, right? An office in Tel Aviv as part of his modeling agency with Epstein. And so here in this picture, you can see Brunel wearing a cap that reads Israeli Army. Again, that's perhaps not the most incriminating thing, but do keep it in mind. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Graham Elwood. He's an American comedian, podcaster, and writer. He hosts a progressive YouTube show and podcast called The Political Vigilante. He's also the co-host of Government Secrets with Lee Camp. Graham has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for several years now, which even resulted in his YouTube channel being demonetized. Graham, could you maybe just to start off give us a very brief overview of the Epstein case in the simplest terms so anyone can get it?
I have a whole Epstein playlist on my YouTube channel, and one of the most critical interviews I would ask people to watch is where I interview a former child crimes investigator, my friend Eric Oldenburg, who was on the Phoenix Police Department for 24 years, and he investigated online basically child trafficking and child pornography and pretty gnarly stuff. And I mean, he said, you know, anyone can be a pedophile, any socioeconomic status, any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation. Sexual orientation doesn't even necessarily correlate. He said, but the people that can get away with it the most are the wealthy and most powerful. And that's what the Epstein case is. If you want to understand how the ruling elites operate, start paying attention to the Epstein case, because you've got in the intelligence community, specifically CIA and Mossad, are their handprints are all over this. And, you know, like, with these examples, just some basic stuff. So when Epstein was arrested in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2008, 2009 in that area, Acosta was the prosecutor, and he was told to that Epstein was a CIA asset and to back off, and that's why he gave him a very lenient case, charge, basically. He got the got to leave his prison every day and fly around and literally traffic and abuse girls.
And when you mention powerful people and the ruling elites, you know, you have a lot of pictures, photographs of celebrities and very rich and important personalities that have photographed with Epstein or Maxwell. And we've also heard of this black book full of names. Could you basically tell us what that is and why we see so many important people photographed with Epstein and you know, people related, people in his entourage?
One of the things, and this has been confirmed in other places, one of the things Epstein would do, he'd have these parties with the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. Billionaires, politicians, I mean, presidents, several different royal families, including the Saudis and the British royal family. And so this powerful person would come in. One of Epstein's butlers would say, hey, would you like a massage from a beautiful young woman? The guy would say yes. And it would be, they'd have sex and it would be a child. And they'd videotape it. Then Epstein would say, well, now I've got evidence of you having sex with a child. And they would then invest in Epstein's, he had some like fake hedge fund. So this is one of the ways Epstein got power. And this is why the intelligence community went, oh, this is an asset, because now we can use these videotapes as leverage. So what is so significant here, Richard, is when Epstein was arrested in July of 2019, we saw the video and the footage of the guys in the FBI coats dragging out, you know, not dragging, but like wheeling out on dolly trucks, boxes of photos, videos, hard drives, all this stuff. None of it. We have seen any of it. So what we have seen is just these little snippets. We've seen like the photos you've seen online. We've seen the flight logs. And I think the flight logs are very critical as well. They show stuff like Bill Clinton on his plane 26 times, Hillary on his plane two times. Trump was originally thought to only be on one time, but more flight logs were released at the end of December during the Maxwell trial, showing Trump was actually on five times. So to your question here, where is that information? Well, that is the reason why this stuff is getting swept under the rug, because the richest, most powerful people are on video. So that's why Jean-Luc Brunel is dead, is because he probably wouldn't play ball or had information or threatened to make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I'll give you these videotapes, give me a lighter sentence. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, he's so distraught, he's going to hang himself. It's believed that Maxwell has so much information, and she's ruthless. She plays hardball, that she has, you know, I don't know, some people will call it like whatever you are, like a kill switch, basically. My belief is Ghislaine Maxwell said, if I go down, you
sorry
go
to cut
down.
You off. I was going to ask you about the Maxwell trial, about Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, how does she tie into Epstein? What's the relationship, and why is she so important to this case? And what did you make of the trial that took place a few months ago?
We'll call her socialite, Epstein's gal pal, maybe even a recruiter. But according to several Epstein victims, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre and Maria Farmer and Maria Farmer's sister, Annie Farmer, she participated. So she's a pedophile. Like, let's be real clear here. And the media will not call Ghislaine Maxwell a pedophile. She is a pedophile and a sex trafficker. And all the women that survived said Maxwell treated them horribly. She treated them like trash.
Well, I mean, speaking of these political connections, one thing that I was really interested in asking you is that, you know, the connections to the Mossad, because you mentioned it briefly at the beginning. If I recall correctly, Brunel, he had one of these modeling agency offices in Tel Aviv. Right. And we've heard many times that Maxwell is connected to the Mossad. Could you explain what that connection is and how this relates to the intelligence, specifically U.S. and Israeli?
Maxwell's father was a Mossad agent, and he had a mysterious death, jumped off a boat or some very sort of odd, mysterious death. So you have that. Then you have, as I stated earlier, Acosta said at an interview in 2009 that he was told to go easy on the prosecution of Epstein in Florida because he was this is Acosta's words, not mine, a quote, CIA asset, right? And then you have, again, John Kiriakou said this in my interview with him. And I asked him about the CIA. I said, does the CIA condone getting children for pedophiles? He goes, no. But if you went, I'm going to get a child for this pedophile because if I get him children, then we can leverage that and use him as an asset. The CIA would go, okay, because they just want the leverage and the intel. And then seeing how, again, going back to Epstein's like fake hedge fund, these guys would donate money to it. And I'm blanking on the names. There was another big hedge fund guy. I can't keep track of all their names, but he donated or invested a lot of money with Epstein, and then women have spoken out against him. So what intelligence is doing, they needed people like Epstein to help them get leverage on all of these people. And they were like, look, Epstein, we'll let him have, you know, do whatever he wants on his plane and on his island as long as he keeps feeding us intel. Until he kept getting, I think Epstein was one of these guys that was so egregious with it that then he became a problem and they got rid of him. From the intelligence standpoint, if they've got video of somebody or some evidence, then that person's easy to control. If that person is found guilty and goes to prison, they don't have them. That person has no more power. They have no more leverage. So they need these key people to get all this stuff done. And they've got, you know, leverage on, you know, the Saudi royal family. They've got, and you know, as I said, John Kiriakou said, this feels like the Israelis. He felt like Mossad, his first gut instinct as a former CIA operative was that Mossad was involved in Epstein's death. This all feels very coordinated and maneuvered by those two intelligence agencies.
There is one really important aspect, though, that the victims themselves have underscored, which is that Jeffrey Epstein used these girls to blackmail powerful people. And so, yes, Epstein and Ghislaine are very obviously depraved individuals who preyed on others. But they also did this to get dirt on the wealthy, on politicians, on businessmen, and anyone that mattered. And they did this in service of Israeli intelligence. They did this at the behest of the Mossad. And again, that's not only speculation. This is now confirmed. It's on the record, confirmed by former Israeli intelligence officials, as we were just going through. And so in addition to all of the already vile, deplorable sexual assaults that this entire saga is mired with, we can see now that there is very clearly a political dimension to it as well. And the fact that the media won't talk about this and never tackle this angle, it really speaks volumes, right? Why do they refuse to talk about this? And how come, despite unsealing so many documents, the courts still continue to keep many of them under wraps? What are they hiding from us exactly? And what could be the other dark secrets in the spy world that we're yet to discover? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses and with no pushback from the regime's allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading International Silence Fuels Israeli Regime Persecution. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's recent designation of several prominent Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations should be easy for liberal democracies to condemn. The designations were handed out based on secret evidence and came without any due process. The organizations in question are highly respected locally and well integrated into the international human rights scene. But the EU, US, Canada, and UK have yet to explicitly reject the Zionist regime's shabby attempt. In the words of Zayd Raad al-Hussein, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, to sully the reputations of Palestinian human rights defenders, None of these governments appear convinced by the Zionist regime's accusations, but they have not even given their ally a deadline to present credible evidence justifying the designations aimed at starving those groups of international funding. And in its attempt to isolate and marginalize these groups, some of which provide key services to Palestine's most vulnerable communities, the Zionist regime is profoundly upending the lives of the human rights and social service providers in its crossers. One of those human rights defenders is Khatam Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. In February, Safin was sentenced to 16-month imprisonment by an Israeli regime military court. She was already in Israeli regime detention and had been since November 2020. Half of that time was spent in administrative detention without charge or trial. When the Zionist regime finally did level charges against Safin, they alleged that she was helping to oversee the transfer of funds from the now-outlawed Palestinian groups, including the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. As is typical of its cases against Palestinians dragged through its military court system, the Zionist regime's case against Safin relied on secret evidence to which neither she nor her lawyer were privy. Like many Palestinians denied due process in the Zionist regime's military court system, Safin agreed to a plea deal that dropped the money laundering charges. She was convicted of membership in the PFLP and to being president of the now Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Wamir observes that the Zionist regime initially leveled a long set of inflated charges against Safin, well beyond any singular specific act she allegedly carried out. This is another time-worn Israeli regime tactic. Inflating the number of charges is a practice widely used by the Zionist regime military prosecution to extend detention and trial procedures as a punitive and coercive measure against the detainee, Al-Wamir adds. In other words, the Zionist regime throws a spaghetti pot of charges at the wall and very little sticks. But deprived of anything resembling a fair trial, Palestinian detainees agree to plead guilty to lesser offenses they did not commit to curtail their ordeal and time away from their families. The Zionist regime also pressures Palestinians to accept IDEA plea deals in order to avoid having to prove their case against them in court. When Palestinians don't accept the plea deals, the process drags on. Muhammad Al-Halabi, a charity worker living in Gaza, is a case in point. On seemingly unending trial, Al-Halabi has been detained for more than a half a decade, and his case has gone to court some 170 times. Al-Halabi has turned down numerous plea deals, refusing to admit guilt for a crime he insists he did not commit. That is the hellish ordeal that Safin 60 was facing, and it was what Jonah Reshmavi 63 was up against when she took a similar plea deal that saw her sentenced to 13 months in prison for her work with the Palestinian Health Work Committees, a group declared illegal by the Zionist regime nearly 2020. The Health Work Committees was not informed of the designation until the Zionist regime began an escalated campaign against the organization, arresting its director, Shatta Odeh, and closing its headquarters in Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Odeh 60 has been in Israeli regime detention since occupation troops stormed her home in July last year. The charges against Odeh primarily revolve around her leadership role in the health work committees, according to Al-Damir. Odeh is also the chair of the Palestinian NGO Network, a coalition of dozens of Palestinian civil society groups. Al-Damir argues that the arrest of Odeh indicates the Zionist regime's increasing brazenness in clamping down and criminalizing Palestinian human rights defenders and civil society organizations that challenge the Zionist regime's settler colonialism and apartheid. Ultimately, the terror designations and the Zionist regime's long-standing campaign against Palestinian human rights defenders is aimed at preserving its impunity. The Zionist regime's moves against these individuals and groups is also a sign of desperation that it is losing its grip on the narrative, with a growing consensus among international human rights groups that the Zionist regime is practicing apartheid against Palestinians. Shawan Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, one of the targeted organizations, told a panel recently convened by the Carter Center, "We remove the mask from their faces. Global human rights consensus now holds that the Zionist regime is a colonial regime. This is an oppressive regime. We crossed the red lines when we came to the issue of accountability and going after the Israeli criminals," he added. During that same event, Wissam Ahmad, also with Al-Haq, noted that the terror designations and other moves against the Palestinian groups are being issued by the same Israeli regime officials being investigated by the International Criminal Court. The movement at the level of the International Criminal Court is something that the Palestinian civil society organizations such as Al-Haq have been heavily involved in pushing forward, and despite the Zionist regime's attempts to stifle the progress towards this investigation, it has continued to move forward. Ahmad said it comes as no surprise that the Israeli regime would take such action during the process of investigation at the ICC. It's very much a reflection of the apartheid tactics to persecute those organizations and individuals that are seeking to challenge that regime. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses, and with no pushback from Israeli allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the south of Iran and saw the most amazing combination nature could match together, the desert and the sea. We also met the region's native inhabitants and got acquainted with their unique lifestyle. Stay with us as Javad travels to other villages of the region to discover the culture and customs of the people.
In the past, staple grains for all of Iran came from Sistan and Balochistan. But what for severe drought spells and misguided planning over the years, the province has completely lost that status. But today, in some areas of this province, and in the Bahu Kalat district in particular, all kinds of vegetables and tropical fruits are cultivated. There is a mango tree that's in full bloom, exploding with blossoms. In about 5 months, they will turn into delicious, juicy mangoes. This is heaven indeed. Walking around in the palm groves and other gardens in Bahu Kalat gives me a lot of peace. One of the most beautiful things I come across during my stroll is the Baluchi squirrel. The Baluchi squirrel, also known as the stripy or palm squirrel, is a unique species of rodents living in parts of Iran, Pakistan, India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. The most distinctive feature of this mammal is the dark stripes on a white background on its back. In the past, the inhabitants of Sistan and Balochistan believed these stripes were the fingerprints of the gods. A typical Baluchi squirrel is between 13 and 15 centimeters from its head to the end of its rump, and its tail adds an additional 14 to 19 centimeters to its total length. It's quite refreshing to see Baluchi children playing and gallivanting around in the banana groves. Beautiful, pure souls, the product of their serene, peaceful surroundings. Children of Shir Gwaz spend the whole week waiting to go to the fruit groves near the village to expend some of their inexhaustible energy. What they also do is they cook their traditional food on their own, and just like their elders, they gather around, sing, and play. The kids here have distinctive, innocent faces. They are just gorgeous. And they're all wearing their traditional costumes, boys and girls alike. All wearing traditional clothes. They are among the oldest, most original tribes in Iran. They're very noble and very patient. They are a people with a lot of patience. And although some of them don't have good living conditions, they are very patient folks. They're so content. The Baluchi culture is the perfect example of a culture of nobility and peace. And those cultural traits are readily visible in the architecture of the old houses in this village. The architectural design is endemic to Balochistan. You can't see anything like this anywhere else in Iran. There are also new houses in these areas with designs influenced by Indian and Pakistani cultures and architectures. One of the characteristics of Baluch families is their large populations. Wherever in the village I go, I'm surrounded by many of the little angels offering a breath of fresh air after a long day of hard work. They fill my heart with peace and joy. Perhaps one of the reasons these kids are so happy is their beautiful, tranquil, natural environs. Just as influential is the beautiful, happy colors used